Welcome, friends. James Corbett here. Today is the 12th of June, 2014, and you are, of course, tuned into CorbettReport.com. Today, we are talking to James Perloff, contributing editor to the New American Magazine and the author of, amongst other works, the best-selling and highly recommended exposé of the Council on Foreign Relations, The Shadows of Power. His new book is Truth is a Lonely Warrior, Unmasking the Forces Behind Global Destruction, and he can be found at jamesperloff.com. Mr. Perloff, thank you very much for joining us today on the Corbett Report.
Thank you, James, for having me on, as you've had many, many informative guests on before.
And you will be another notch in the belt, I suppose. So let's get straight into it. As I mentioned in that introduction, your latest book is Truth is a Lonely Warrior. And although I haven't had the opportunity to read it yet, I cannot express how eager I am to do so based on my experience of reading your now 26-year-old book, The Shadows of Power, which I can personally attest is extremely well-researched and extremely well-documented. And for people who believe that those are two tenets of the Corbett Report, you might concede that I know of where I speak on these issues. So although the CFR is much more familiar to the American public now than it was 26 years ago, even the alt media, I think, has yet to really make much use of the work, the pioneering work that you did on this subject in this book. So let's go back to the era in which you were writing this, back in that era where even the mention of the word Council on Foreign Relations was a conspiracy theory amongst much of the public. What prompted you to begin researching this subject and documenting the influence of this organization?
Well, I'd always had an interest in what's taking place in our world, but what I had learned in standard public school and college textbooks never was very edifying to me. And eventually, this is the sort of thing that doesn't happen normally to me. Some people will say, God told me to do something. And I had these experiences only once about every 10 years, but I saw a girl who was reading a book called None Dare Call a Conspiracy by Gary Allen. And I didn't know anything about the book, but something simply told me I had to get a copy of that book. And I just had this compulsion. I had to find that book. So I went to a bookstore and they had a copy and I read it. And for the first time, history began to make sense. And but as I read it, I also realized that there were some gaps in this book. And as I started to access the resources listed in his footnotes, learn more about the pattern of history, a much truer and accurate pattern than I had been exposed to before, I really felt a desire to write something myself because I had some innate writing skill and I wanted to do something to communicate to others the same experience of revelation that I'd had.
And what an experience that must have been in order for to prompt this amount of research and this thorough exploration of the subject. And I would like to think, I assume, that most of the people in the Corbett Report audience will already be familiar with the Council on Foreign Relations, at the very least in general terms, as an ominous influence over American foreign policy and something that's really invaded and infested the U.S. State Department in the time of its existence, going back, of course, to 1921. But I suppose we could talk about the origins of the Council on Foreign Relations as a way of trying to identify where it really came from. And I suppose we could go back hundreds of years to talk about those origins. As you do mention in this book, this really does go back to an international banking confederacy that predates our modern era. In fact, predates really the existence of the United States itself. But let's start more in the 20th century and identify some of the key players who were instrumental in forming this. And in order to do that, why don't we first dissect the CFR's official explanation of its own history on CFR.org. Right now, you can go to the About History section where it says, after the difficult negotiations of the 1919 Paris Peace Conference, a group of diplomats, financiers, generals, and lawyers concluded that Americans needed to be better prepared for significant responsibilities and decision-making in world affairs. With this in mind, they founded the Council on Foreign Relations in 1921 to afford a continuous conference on international questions affecting the United States by bringing together experts on statecraft, finance, industry, education, and science, which makes it sound like a very noble effort indeed. But at the very least, perhaps they were right to identify the group of diplomats, financiers, generals, and lawyers who were really the core nucleus of this group, emphasis on financiers and lawyers. Why don't we talk about some of the people who helped to bring this together and what their real agenda was?
Well, Woodrow Wilson had been brought in by the banking community to advance their agenda. The White House had been ruled by Wall Street, Morgan, Rockefeller Republicans for 16 years up until 1912, but there was a revolt going on in the Republican Party led by people like Senator Robert La Follette and Congressman Charles Lindbergh, and they decided to let the Republican Party cool off for a while. La Follette was aiming for the nomination, and they got Woodrow Wilson elected. They were able to secure his election by splitting the Republican vote. They trotted out the former Republican President Teddy Roosevelt on the short-lived Bull Moose ticket, which split Republican votes and gave Wilson the presidency with only 42% of the popular vote. And Wilson fulfilled a lot of their objectives. And, of course, one of those objectives was the Federal Reserve, which came into being in his first year in office. And I know your listeners know all about that. He also had committed himself to banker Bernard Baruch, who was one of his overseers, that he would support an income tax that actually slightly preceded his nomination, able to get that through as well. And he also promised to lend an ear to advice should war break out in Europe. And did he ever lend an ear to advice? Of course, he appointed Bernard Baruch to be head of the War Industries Board, and that enabled the banksters to defraud the American people out of about $6 billion in war munitions that were never produced or delivered. All of that was uncovered by the what's called the Graham Committee of Congress, which had a 21-volume report after a three-year investigation. Yet, if you go to Wikipedia today, you won't even find an entry for the Graham Committee. It's disappeared down one of George Orwell's memory holes. But Woodrow Wilson was a very faithful servant. He was also instrumental, of course, as many of your listeners probably know, in securing the release of Leon Trotsky, who was on his way to Russia to help foment the Bolshevik Revolution in 1917. He'd been sent by Jacob Schiff of Kuhn Loeb, the Rothschild banking satellite in New York City. Of course, Jacob Schiff was also one of the three top financial backers, Woodrow Wilson. So he was very instrumental, and a lot of those changes were taking place in that decade, the Bolshevik Revolution and the income tax and the Federal Reserve. And of course, isn't it interesting that the Federal Reserve and the income tax came to being just months before the assassination of Archduke Ferdinand, the 100th anniversary of which is this month. So America was all ready to finance its involvement in the war. But sorry to bring it up to the Council on Foreign Relations, the bankers had a goal of world government. And of course, you could not get a world government simply into place. You're part of this group called Boiling Frog, is that correct?
The Boiling Frogs Post, boilingfrogspost.com.
Right. Well, that is a concept that the banksters and the Council on Foreign Relations have constantly used in advancing their agenda. They know you can't put things over on people too swiftly, but if you do it one bit at a time, in fact, Elihu Root when the Council on Foreign Relations opened the new headquarters in 1929, compared the council's mission to that of the building of that structure, one brick at a time. That's how foreign policy had to be made. So with world government, they couldn't just impose a all-powerful world government, which of course is the ultimate goal. They had to start out, just as they started out the income tax at 1%, now, well, lo and behold, you're paying double digit. But they had to start out with a loose confederation, the League of Nations, and that was the 14th point of the famous 14 points that Woodrow Wilson brought to the Paris Peace Conference, which was settling the aftermath of World War One. And of course, he had to work very hard to get us into that war so that America could have a say at the conference table. And of course, that was instituted. And when he went to the conference, it's interesting that Wilson did not bring a single member of the Democratic Party, not a single congressman or senator was invited, but he invited Bernard Baruch as his economic advisor, and Paul Warburg, who he had previously named the vice chairman of the Federal Reserve, he invited him to come as head of the American delegation to the Paris Peace Conference. And of course, he was always under the eye of Edward Mandel House, CFR founder and bankster frontman who had been controlling him throughout his tenure in the White House. In fact, Edward Mandel House lived right in the White House. So that was the mission. it was to create a world government. But ironically, the Senate, which Wilson had kind of snubbed when he went over to Paris, they did not ratify the treaty. Now, the Constitution of the United States said that to make a treaty, no president could do that unilaterally. He had to have approval from Congress. He didn't get it. The Senate rejected the Versailles Treaty, which created the League of Nations, so we did not join. And so the motivation for the Council on Foreign Relations, when the banksters in Paris got the news that the Senate had rejected the Versailles Treaty, they realized that America was not ready for this step yet. And so they had to create an organization that would change the climate of opinion in America so Americans would become friendly to the idea of world government. And so the council was, they decided to create the council, and it was incorporated 2 years later in New York City, 1921.
And now, the idea that this organization really was created specifically for the purpose of indoctrinating the American public into the idea of becoming part of this new world order, new international order, the world government, what have you, is something that, again, you document exhaustively in your book. And I'll just turn to the opening section where you do a very effective quotation from a few different publications in CFR history from different eras, just to show that this is a constant theme in their publications, going right back to the second ever edition of Foreign Affairs, the CFR's official publication, where there was an article that wrote that that said, obviously, there is going to be no peace or prosperity for mankind so long as it remains divided into 50 or 60 independent states. Equally obviously, there is going to be no steady progress in civilization or self-government among the more backward peoples until some kind of international system is created, which will put an end to the diplomatic struggles incident to the attempt of every nation to make itself secure. The real problem today is that of world government. And then a 1944 council publication, the American Public Opinion and Post-War Security Commitments, which noted, the sovereignty fetish is still so strong in the public mind that there would appear to be little chance of winning popular assent to American membership in anything approaching a super state organization. Again, this goes on in 1959 in study number 7, Basic Aims of U.S. Foreign Policy, talking about building a new international order. You cite the 1974 edition of Foreign Affairs, talking about the hard road to world order, fall 1984 edition of Foreign Affairs, including a piece by Kurt Waldheim, the former Secretary General of the UN and a former Nazi, writing again about how sovereign entities need to be subject to a higher authority, talking about international organizations. Again, this is not some idea that that conspiracy theorists are trying to insert on the CFR framework. It is something that is absolutely baked into the cake. Let's talk about the development of this idea of globalization, how it has been propounded by this organization, and the effect that it's had in shaping the institutions that now so dominate the American foreign policy machinery.
Right. And just by the way, just to bring it up to date, since that book was published in 1988, I'll give you a quote from Richard Haass, the president of the Council on Foreign Relations, from 2006, just to show the continuum. He wrote this in a newspaper editorial. He said, quote, the title was State Sovereignty Must Be Altered in Globalized Era. He said, quote, states must be prepared to cede some sovereignty to world bodies if the international system is to function. This is already taking place in the trade realm. Some governments are prepared to give up elements of sovereignty to address the threat of global climate change. All of this suggests that sovereignty must be redefined if states are to cope with globalization. Globalization implies that sovereignty is not only becoming weaker in reality, but that it needs to become weaker. States would be wise to weaken sovereignty in order to protect themselves because they cannot insulate themselves from what goes on elsewhere. Sovereignty is no longer a sanctuary, unquote. This is a common theme from 1922 until today. It is unchanging. And one of those quotes, I believe you gave the quote from Gardner on the hard road to world order. They decided that it was going to be hard to impose world government from the top down. In other words, just to strengthen the UN. So they've been concentrating on various elements or building blocks, the bricks of the building that Root was talking about. So maybe the Kyoto Protocol, NAFTA, the common market in one era, which became the European Union, the Law of the Sea Treaty, the proposed North American Union, NATO, of course, a proposed transatlantic trade partnership, which is a reflection of the old Atlantic Union that they were trying to put forward in the 1950s, all these building blocks of a global world order, but with an ultimate goal, of bringing about a world government. And there's a key quote from Zbigniew Brzezinski. He said this in 1995. This helps us to understand this. This is, again, another quote that came out post-publication of my book. He said, quote, "We cannot leap into world government in one quick step. The precondition for genuine globalization is progressive regionalization," unquote. So they're going to boil the frog, James. They're going to have this come about step by step. They're not going to do it all at once, but we're definitely headed that way. And all the chatter about prosperity and the benefits of globalization are for this ultimate world government, which would certainly be a tyranny.
Well, let's talk specifics then. You note, of course, how the CFR was really born from the ashes of the failure of the United States to ratify the League of Nations. But the CFR, of course, also had a hand in the creation of the League of Nations successor organization, the United Nations. Tell us about the War and Peace Studies Group and how the CFR contributed to the formation of the UN.
Well, just a couple of weeks after the outbreak of war in Europe, the invasion of Poland by Germany in September 1939, just 2 weeks later that the editor of Foreign Affairs, Hamilton Fish Armstrong, and Walter Mallory, who was executive director of the Council on Foreign Relations, met with the State Department, and it was decided that the Council on Foreign Relations would work with the State Department, and was called it became known as the War and Peace Studies Project, and they formulated almost 700 papers for the State Department and for President Roosevelt as to what our wartime and post-war policy should be. And of course, it's out of that War and Peace Studies Project that the plans for the World Bank and IMF came about, which of course are schemes by which taxpayers bail out big multinational banks. And of course, they were getting ready for the United Nations. And it's interesting that ever since we signed the UN Charter, we've never had a declaration of war. Up until then, we had declarations of war. But when you got into Korea, which was a UN action, Harry Truman sent our troops to Korea, and he did not get a declaration of war, explained to the press that we're not at war. This is a police action. Well, some police action, 100,000 casualties, over 30,000 dead. But you didn't need a declaration of war anymore because we'd ceded our sovereignty to the UN, which was a goal that they had been working on in the War and Peace Studies Project.
Exactly right. And again, let's put that into perspective, because the United Nations, of course, is completely separate from the United States State Department. But of course, many of the aims and agendas of this organization have become adopted by the State Department over the course of its history, to the point where these days, I mean, there's a lot of, at least in terms of the rhetoric that comes from a lot of the State Department officials, they do seem to be quite in line with the United Nations aims and towards this idea of constructing some sort of international order. Let's talk about that and how the United States is increasingly being wedded into the United Nations infrastructure.
Well, just to expand on your comment that the State Department represents their views, there's a quote that I imagine a number of your listeners have heard. You can see it on YouTube. Hillary Clinton, as Secretary of State for Obama, was speaking at the Council's Washington branch. And I'll give you the exact quote. You can find that on YouTube very easily. She said, quote, "I have often been to, I guess, the mothership in New York City, but it's good to have an outpost of the Council right down the street from the State Department. We get a lot of advice from the Council, so this means I won't have to go as far to be told what we should be doing and how we should think about the future," unquote.
Yes, a big joke, Hillary Clinton. Yes, of course, that was just a joke, James. She didn't mean that seriously.
Well, I think she had a sort of a smirk on her face, at least. So yeah. Might be something to that.
Well, that is, of course, how people would counter that type of quotation. But, of course, I think there's a lot more truth to it than simply a joke.
No, it's not intended to be a joke at all. She was seriously addressing the members of the Washington branch of the Council on Foreign Relations and expressing her gratitude, and nobody was laughing.
Right. So let's extend that. So I think by this point, I think it should be obvious, and we can expand that out if need be, but I think it should be obvious that the State Department has been completely infested by CFR members for a very long time, and we've talked about those numbers before in your works. I'm talking about the number of secretaries of state, for example, who have been CFR members, which at the time of the writing of Shadows of Power, I believe, had been every single, or 14 in a row, or something of that sort. But at this point, I'm sure, again, that streak continues. And I'm not sure about John Kerry himself. I know he recently addressed the Trilateral Commission. I'm assuming he's a CFR member, but I stand to be corrected.
No, you don't need to be corrected on that. And the Treasury Secretary, Jacob Blum, as well as his predecessor, Timothy Geithner, were members, and Chuck Hagel at Defense, as well as his predecessor, Robert Gates, have been members of the Council on Foreign Relations, and head of Homeland Security, Jay Johnson, and his predecessor, Napolitano, members of the Council on Foreign Relations, and Penny Pritzker at Commerce, and Ernest Money is at Energy. They're all members of the Council. And I'll read you a quote from the back of that book I sent you, the new one, Truth is a Lonely Warrior. You can tell what organization I'm talking about, but it says in the back of my new book, it says, quote, since its 1921 founding, what small organization has produced 21 secretaries of defense, 19 Treasury secretaries, 18 secretaries of state, and 16 CIA directors? And of course, that's the council, and those numbers have actually increased since I wrote that jacket blurb. And I should just clarify, when I talk about secretaries of defense, I'm including, of course, the old War Department, which was the previous name for the Defense Department. But the question is, why is it that one organization, you know, they have a little over 4,000 members today, but how is it that one organization is able to dominate the cabinets of both Democratic and Republican presidents? And let me add one more, a current one. This year, Obama, you know, appointed Janet Yellen to head the Federal Reserve in place of Ben Bernanke. Well, she's a CFR member. This year, Obama also named Stanley Fischer vice chairman of the Federal Reserve. He's a CFR member. And he also appointed Lael Brainard and Jerome Powell as governors of the seven-member Federal Reserve Board. So that's four for four. Remember, this organization only has about 4,000 members, yet they dominate. You know what they like to dominate, James? They like to dominate finance and foreign policy and wars and intelligence. So you will see them at the head of the Federal Reserve, the head of the Treasury Department, the head of the State Department, the head of the Defense Department, the head of the CIA, pretty consistently, because those are the areas that they most want to concentrate on. They might, you know, willing to cede the Agriculture Department or some minor post to somebody else, but they dominate the key positions that are needed to reconstruct the world according to globalist aims.
Well, of course, one of the key tenets, one of the key factors in foreign policy is the position of the United States when it comes to foreign military commitments. And when we are looking at the post-World War II era, as you note, of course, the United States has not declared war since the Second World War, that it's always these types of kinetic military actions was, I believe, the phrase that Obama came up with for Libya. So however they choose to define it, of course, they do not ever get Congress to sign off on it anymore. But of course, these decisions are still heavily influenced by the CFR and its membership, and you document again in this book in great detail, talking about the Korean War, the war in Vietnam. We could extend it out past the time frame of this book into the first Gulf War, the second war in Iraq, the war in Afghanistan. Has there been a major military confrontation that the United States has been involved in since the end of the Second World War in which the CFR and its members have not played a prominent role in bringing that conflict about?
I would say that'd be almost impossible given their domination of the Defense Department and the State Department. It would be impossible to separate them from that. If you look at my chapter on the war in Vietnam in the old book, The Shadows of Power, I have the first picture at the end of that chapter. I have a photograph of President Johnson meeting with his advisors on Vietnam. And there's about almost a dozen men in the group, and every single one of them was a member of the Council on Foreign Relations. In fact, maybe I should bring up a relevant quote, which appears near the end of that chapter, is from Congressman John Rarick of Louisiana, who caught on to what was going on in Vietnam. And here's what he said. He said, he talked about how the media was portraying things. He says, but, quote, no one identifies the Council on Foreign Relations, the CFR, a group of some 1,400 Americans, which includes as members almost every top-level decision and policymaker in the Vietnam War. CBS tells the people it wants them to know what is going on and who is to blame. why doesn't CBS tell the American people about the CFR and let the people decide who to blame for the Vietnam fiasco? And he goes on. Of course, the media does not talk about CFR because the media themselves are CFR. They have hundreds of CFR members, and you go through, you'll find that Rupert Murdoch, who runs News Corp, is a CFR member. You go back to the origins of CBS and NBC with William Paley and Robert Sarnoff were CFR members. And when I researched The Shadows of Power, and there was no internet back then, I was doing a lot of library research, I found that on CBS, 11 out of 14 members of their board were CFR members. And, you know, when the media is like any other business, it's the bosses who call the shots. It's the owners and the management. And not only was it I found not only the managers and the owners were CFR members, but so were the newscasters, Tom Brokaw, Dan Rather, McNeil and Lehrer, Diane Sawyer, Katie Couric, Paul Azan. You're not going to get to the top in politics or in media without the approval of what we call the American establishment, which, of course, it's not the Council on Foreign Relations that's actually running things. It's actually, the Council is really an instrument for the power elite.
Well, that's precisely what comes to mind when we start going through these lists of important members in important positions, because we could, I assume, from a detractor might say, well, we have the causality backwards here. Why are you saying that this organization is so ominous because all of these influential people are members of it, implying that somehow the council itself is directing things, whereas one could simply look at this as an organization that powerful and influential people tend to sign up to, that that this is where powerful and influential people congregate, and we would expect them, people in those circles of power, to associate, whether within something like the CFR or another type of organization.
Right. Well, we do have a government structure, bureaucracy and the federal government with cabinet level positions, and it's necessary to fill those. We do have this wealthy elite who's running the show behind the scenes, but they have to have an instrument, a mechanism by which they can connect. Now, people will take due note that there's a strange number of government officials, high-ranking cabinet and sub-cabinet level people, who they always seem to come for these multinational corporations, you know, Halliburton and Exxon and Bechtel. And the Council on Foreign Relations has been one of its functions has been to give some credentials to these businessmen in order to take positions in the government. And let me give you one relevant quote on that. You'll find at least part of this quote in The Shadows of Power, but this is from the New York Times, April 19th, 1985. Quote, the title is, "An investment banker appointed to number two post at state. John C. Whitehead has been named the next deputy secretary of state," it was announced today. "Mr. Whitehead retired last November as co-chairman of Goldman Sachs. Mr. Whitehead brings to the job no apparent expertise in international diplomacy. In describing his attributes for the job, Mr. Schultz," it was George Schultz, Secretary of State, "said that Mr. Whitehead was a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, was regularly invited to dinners given by Henry A. Kissinger, the former Secretary of State," unquote. So what the council does is they'll invite these execs from these multinational corporations to join the council, and then they'll attend some dinners at the council and maybe a study group, and now they're suddenly qualified in diplomacy, and you'll find them in these major positions within the cabinet and within the high-ranking positions within the government bureaucracy.
Right, so it's a type of skin that they can put on to pretend that they have some sort of actual some reason to be involved in the apparatus of the foreign policy decision making in the U.S. government.
Right, and they always like to describe them as the best brains. You know, David Halberstam wrote that book, The Best and the Brightest. And when George Bush was running for president, he said that he was going to bring the best minds and the best brains, and they've always tried to use that. But I always like to point out that intelligence alone, and by the way, I don't think these guys are that intelligent, clever perhaps, but intelligence can be used for evil. What we really need to be concerned about is the agenda these people have and whether or not they're going to use what intelligence they have to really serve the interest of the American people.
Well, that's such an important point, and high-functioning psychopaths can be exceptionally intelligent people. But at any rate, well, let's talk about if the CFR's explicit aim, as we talked about earlier, from its inception, was to shape and mold public opinion in the United States towards accepting this new world order, this internationalization, this globalization, this creation of the world government, then I suppose it would be fruitful to examine how successful they've been in shaping public opinion. And you point out one example of that in the book that I thought was particularly interesting, because even to today, if you think of one of the most vilified politicians of the entire 20th century, it would have to be Joseph McCarthy, who is still equated in the popular imagination with, of course, McCarthyism and witch hunts. And there are still movies made today, talking in Hollywood of circles, of course, about the communist witch hunts that went under McCarthyism, etc. But as you point out in the book, what McCarthy was actually doing, certainly towards the end when he suddenly became this universally vilified person, was slightly different than what the popular imagination holds. Let's talk a little bit about McCarthy and what he was actually starting to uncover.
Well, McCarthy, of course, had correctly observed that there were a great many communists within the American government. And his accusations were not only well documented, as you will find if you read, for example, his book on George Catlin Marshall, America's Retreat from Victory. He was eventually becoming aware of the fact that these communists were not simply, you know, what we think of communist as sort of this dirty, scruffy guy who sells the National Guardian on a street corner type of communist. You realize that it was the upper crust. And of course, we talked a little about the outset about how Kuhn Loeb and Woodrow Wilson had assisted Trotsky in his trip to Russia to start the Bolshevik Revolution. And in fact, had been given $20 million. That there was this, surprising love affair between the capitalists and the communists. And of course, you know, David Rockefeller had private landing rights for his jet in Moscow at the height of the Cold War, and Chase Manhattan was loaning the Soviets money and millions of dollars, and they had the headquarters in Russia at 1 Karl Marx Square. And, you know, Joe McCarthy was starting to catch on that these multinational banks were doing things that would be considered treason. And we touched a little bit there, and I know many of your listeners know about the Rees Committee, which investigated tax-free foundations, and how Norman Dodd, who was director of research for the Rees Committee, went to see Roland Gaither, the head of the Ford Foundation, and Gaither told him quite frankly that the goal of the foundations and the operatives that the directors that were operating under were to eventually create a merger between the United States and the Soviet Union, at which point Dodd said he almost fell out of his chair. And he asked Gaither if he would reveal that to the American public, and Gaither replied, "We would not think of doing this." But that was part of the long-range plan. But McCarthy was starting to catch on, and he went after Marshall, who was one of the top insiders. George Marshall was one of those generals like Eisenhower who had not distinguished himself in the field, but was rather a political general, was advanced by Roosevelt over the heads of many other top brass to become the Army Chief of Staff. Marshall, we want to have an interesting show sometime, we can do one on Pearl Harbor and talk about Marshall's foreknowledge of the Pearl Harbor attack, or he did not warn our men in time, even though he knew full well the attack. He was begged by other men in the War Department. They already had the declaration of war from Japan. Everything indicated an attack was coming. Well, Joe McCarthy wrote a book about Marshall called George Catlett Marshall, who was very close to the Council on Foreign Relations, always in the right place at the right time. In 1945, he became Truman's special envoy to China, which was instrumental in bringing the communists to power in China. Joe McCarthy, that didn't escape his attention. Of course, in 1947, he announced the Marshall Plan. It was named for him. He had nothing to do with the Marshall Plan. That was conceived at a study group at the Council on Foreign Relations, which had David Rockefeller, a young David Rockefeller, as its secretary. They only picked Marshall to announce it because they wanted to get bipartisan congressional support, and they thought as a general, he would appear to be neutral, which he wasn't. But McCarthy was catching on, and he was starting to go after people like Dean Acheson, who is also a very, you know, Dean Acheson, you want to talk about people high up who are affiliated with communists. Dean Acheson's law partner was Donald Hiss, member of the Communist Party and the brother of Alger Hiss, the Soviet spy. Well, so after a while, McCarthy became aware of the fact it's not just these low-level underlings who have somehow infiltrated our government. It's at the very top. And it's when he went after the men at the top that the entire media came down on Joe McCarthy and moves were made to destroy him from the White House on down.
Now, of course, once again, Shadows of Power being written in 1988, at that time, that the book basically brought the story up to that point where, of course, the Soviet Union was still operative at that time, and that long-term goal of merging the U.S. with the Soviet Union was still operative, presumably. But, of course, we are in a different era now in which, well, presumably, the Soviet Union is gone, so it's a completely different era. And what can you say? I mean, obviously, this is going to touch more on what you've written in Truth is the Lonely Warrior, I presume. But what can you say about the modern era of the age of terrorism and how that relates to the CFR agenda and the unfolding agenda towards world government?
Well, the phrase that the Council on Foreign Relations consistently used, and this goes back to 1922, I give examples in the book, that 1922 they were talking about how world government would bring about peace and prosperity. And with the advent of nuclear weapons, there was a thought that war itself, at least on a major level between the world powers, might not be a viable option because nuclear weapons could wipe us out. And so terrorism is eventually replaced war as the threat that they're emphasizing that globalism will save us from. And so you see George Bush meeting with Prime Minister Fox of Mexico and Prime Minister Martin of Canada in 2005 to form what was called the Security and Prosperity Partnership. We noticed this change. Instead of saying peace and prosperity, which implied safety from war, they talked about security and prosperity as implying globalization would give us safety from terrorism. And I'm sure I don't need to tell your listeners anything about all the holes in the official explanation of 9/11. So many of us do believe that it was the result of intrigues between, you know, amongst the intelligence services, probably and possibly including the Mossad of Israel. But terrorism has taken that as they always need a threat to create a crisis to create something new. You need the Great Depression to create the New Deal. You need World War II to create the United Nations. And you need terrorism to has been one of the threats that's been used to invoke a North American Union, which Robert Pastor of the Council on Foreign Relations proposed in Foreign Affairs, saying that we should have a continental Homeland Security Department incorporating Mexican and Canadian personnel.
Exactly right. And of course, that brings us even further towards the Trans-Pacific Partnership and now the equivalent in the Atlantic region, which goes back to what CFR members were writing about again half a century ago, talking about Atlantica, I believe was the phrase that was coined, the merger that they wanted to have in the Atlantic region. So I think we're moving step by step by step towards that ultimate goal.
Yes, they're boiling the frog, always.
Exactly right. Okay, well, I think that sets the table nicely for our next conversation. Once I have a chance to read and digest Truth is the Lonely Warrior, and hopefully some of the listeners out there will be able to buy their copies and read it before we get to that conversation. But then closing today's conversation, talking about the Shadows of Power, I note with some enthusiasm that this is a bestseller. It sold over 100,000 copies in its 26 years of publication, which is pretty remarkable for a book that I can only presume has had zero reviews or input or any sort of attention from any mainstream media sources, CFR-run media sources. So tell us about the reception of this book and how it's managed to propagate so far.
Well, it was certainly helped by the fact that this book was published by Western Islands, which was a branch of the John Birch Society. And I know that the Birch Society has been criticized in recent years for not going far enough on things like 9-1-1. But, you know, back in the 60s, they were kind of like the truth movement. You know, there's no real truth movement back then. And when I was a teenager in the 60s living in Greater Boston, you know, the only sources of information we had as far as what was going on in the world was either you got the Boston Globe, which represented the Democratic Party, or the Boston Herald, which represented the Republican Party point of view, or you had the three TV networks, you know, NBC, CBS, and ABC. And there was no truth movement. And unless you knew somebody in the Birch Society or one of the other, maybe very small groups, there was no way to, there was no internet. And there was, your public library, you might find some musty old book written by Harry Emler Barnes that disputed the cause of World War One. But as a teenager back then, you really weren't interested in it. There was just no alternative media, really, unless you happen to know, be fortunate enough to know somebody. The Shadows of Power has been well received. But the point I was going to make was that one thing that was helpful was having an organization working with me, because its members became involved in selling the book, and they still are involved in selling it. And that was one thing that helped. But of course, I've also done many PowerPoint talks where I sell the book. And of course, I have a website now. And the modern means of communication we have, the social media, it's much easier to sell a book in many respects than it was before. We're not sh- there was a day when if you wanted to publish a book, you pretty much had to go to one of the big publishing houses and wait for your rejection slip to come in the mail. There wasn't much in the way of alternative publishing houses. Western Islands, the branch of the John Birch Society, was one. There was Henry Regnery was one, Devin A. Daring in Connecticut. But, you know, you weren't going to make the Book of the Month Club. As you were saying, we've been ignored by the major media. But the people do respond to the truth. And I like to say that that's one thing we have on our side that the major media don't. We have the truth. They have money on their side. We have the truth, and I'll go with the truth any day.
Well, absolutely. I couldn't agree with that more. And I couldn't recommend strongly enough The Shadows of Power. Once again, I am just blown away by the depth of this research. I did read it, but I will have to read it again to really digest, I think, all of the different information in here. And I think even though it is 26 years old, I think there is still a huge amount of very important historical data in here. And as I say, I'm very much looking forward to Truth is a Lonely Warrior. So once again, people can go to jamesperloff.com and to order their copies of both of those books. Are they available directly from the website?
I just redirect people over to Amazon. It's a lot easier for me than packing them all up myself.
Understandable. All right. Well, this is the age that we're living in, and although there are many downsides to it, well, some of the upsides are, as you note, that we don't require the organizational behemoths anymore so much to get the word out. And so let's take advantage of this while we can and try to get this truth and information out the best way that we can. So James Perloff, my hat's off to you for the incredible work that you've done, at which attentive listeners of the Corbett Report will remember I've cited in several episodes now, talking about some of your PowerPoint presentations about The Shadows of Power, which I've played in the podcast before. So hopefully people will not be completely unfamiliar with your work. But for those who are, please go to jamesperloff.com, check it out, and purchase the book, and find out for yourself some of this incredible information. I think we'll leave it there for today. James Perloff, thank you again for your time.
Thank you so much, James.